once again. The title of this talk is called Increasing Your Capacity for Joy. And I feel like I should just hand it over to Alfie. We could just watch him. He's a total bliss machine. It's great to have the audible, you know, during the meditation. That was great. About, maybe it was at least 20 years ago, out of my inspiration and naivete, I created a 7-day program called The Art of Joyful Living. This was when I lived in an ashram. And the person I was leading it with was very excited about this as well, and we thought, this will be great. We're going to do, like, writing and improv and, like, dance and all these incredibly joyful things. And to my utter surprise, the saddest, most depressed people came to that program. And, of course, it instantly made sense. We're all drawn to the idea of being more joyful, particularly when we're feeling the lack of it. So I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about how it is that we cultivate joy and how it's tied into how we pay attention. Because there's some very interesting paradoxes in cultivating joy in the practice of meditation. I guess the first thing I want to share is that we don't automatically associate joy with Buddhism or Buddhist meditation. Because when you're looking from the outside, it doesn't look very happy, especially if you've seen people doing walking meditation. You know, you've seen people doing the walking practice. You know, the eyes are kind of cast down and walking very slowly with awareness. And I was thinking about this, and back in the ashram days, we had about 300 people in our community. And one of the community members really wanted his parents to come and see this place. And they were completely freaked out, you know, about, you know, the cult that he was living in and all that stuff. And he kept saying, no, they're really, really nice people, and we work hard and we play hard, and I just think you're really going to love it. And so finally they decided they would come on some weekend. And it turned out that weekend we were having a retreat for all the residents. And back in those days we all wore white, you know, as a sign of our, you know, pure intentions. And they just happened to drive up the driveway when 300 of us were doing walking meditation outside wearing white. You can imagine what went through their minds, you know, because everyone's walking very slowly, you know, with their eyes cast down, and we look pretty drugged, I think. And of course, if you read anything about Buddhism or you begin to study Buddhist psychology, it's about suffering. There's a lot of talk about suffering, identifying the causes of suffering, of identifying what's between you and feeling free. And inevitably, when we begin to practice with any authenticity, with any really deep sincerity, the practice will eventually take us to contact kind of the shadow parts of ourself. It automatically brings us to the places in our lives that are undigested, that are wanting attention, that are needing compassion. The practice takes us to the places that aren't integrated. And we begin to see with more and more clarity the different qualities of mind that are between us and clear seeing and clear feeling. I tend to think of this practice as kind of a purification practice. The more you focus on being present, the more you become aware of how you're not present. That's the bad news. The good news is you get to see in very clear detail where you have choices, where new possibilities might exist where they didn't exist before. So there's this sense of it's just suffering, suffering, and more suffering. And yet, the records that survive from the Buddhist tradition oftentimes would comment on how the communities were really well known for their joy and for the lightness that that were held in the communities. So there's a very interesting paradox here to really draw our attention to, really investigate what's between you and feeling joy. If you just were to even reflect now, if you could think of three things that are between you and feeling joy, chances are you could identify them pretty quickly. Personal anxieties, worries about the future, things that are out relationally with someone. We kind of have a shopping list we can identify of what's between us and feeling joyful. So there's a paradox here. If we want to be present, well, then we have to identify what's between us and being present. If we want to have an awakened heart, then we have to identify what's between us and that sense of a wide open, compassionate heart. And in that same way, to be joyful, we've got to do our homework to recognize what's between us and feeling that joy. And there are some inherent traps when we explore what it means to cultivate joy. There's something called premature joy or premature transcendence, when we sort of pretend that everything's okay when it really isn't. And I remember back in my days of living in spiritual community, that sense of premature transcendence kind of was rife because everyone wanted to be enlightened, so they kind of pretended they were enlightened. And of course, there was a huge shadow that never really got digested until we kind of grew up to sort of name that and had the courage to investigate it. So there's something here about being really honest with ourselves, about really identifying, so what's true? What is truly between me and feeling free, feeling joyful? And taking the time to name it, to investigate it. When we begin to look at joy, we can also begin to identify what the Buddha called the near enemies of joy. And these are the false states that, if we don't investigate them fully, they kind of look like joy, but they're not really the authentic experience. Being a hypocrisy or affectation, that's sort of like pretend joy. It kind of looks like it, but it's not the real thing. And the Buddha also talked about the opposite of joy is jealousy. The comparison, the judgment, the wanting that the mind inevitably goes into. And when we find ourselves caught in that weather system of jealousy, joy is the furthest thing available to us. Another quality that we can cultivate in joy, kind of the practice or the cultivation of joy, is referred to in Pali as mudita, or sympathetic joy, which is kind of training ourselves to be happy for other people's happiness. It's a very interesting practice. Like, I noticed that when I kind of blew out my knees and I couldn't run anymore, that whenever I would see someone run, there would be a kind of a tight sort of jealous feeling. I've sort of retrained myself now. When I see someone out running, I just sort of say to myself, oh my gosh, you can still run. That's a good thing. Really happy for them. There's another quality of joy, which is a false joy, which is kind of a spaciness. When we feel sort of spaced out, it can have a quality of pleasantness to it. But that spaciness also has a quality of laziness. So what is true joy? And the Buddha talks a little bit about this as well. The real experience of joy, it's very interesting to see that joy is only accessible from presence. We have to be fully and deeply and intimately here for the possibility of joy to emerge. Joy cannot show up in anticipation. We can have a false sense of joy of anticipating something that we're going to get down the road. There can also be a sense of joy reflecting on something we had in the past. but the experience of what we call unconditional joy, which is the joy that comes free of causes and conditions, is only available by training our awareness into the here and now. One of the great things about teaching that I love is how much it heightens my awareness of my own experience. And each morning I live very near the Potomac River. So every morning I try to get down to the river before sunrise with all my camera gear and to catch that early morning light. It's just unbelievably magical. And a couple days ago, I hauled all my stuff down to the river. It's, a relatively long walk. And I was feeling kind of headachy and kind of cold. And, the sky looked like it was going to be good, but it was still kind of gray, so the light wasn't really the way I wanted it to be. And I got there a little bit early, so I had to kind of like stand around in the cold, damp, cold, waiting for the light to come up, and it looked kind of like lousy light anyway. And so I just kind of thought, well, where's the joy here? And I realized that I was just really kind of unhappy down there. Nothing was going my way. And then I realized that the reason things weren't going my way was because I was declaring that they weren't going my way. I had kind of made up my mind that things weren't going my way. So I started to, as I was doing kind of standing meditation, I started to explore what it would be like to let go of labels, just to let go of good or bad, and just to kind of feel that raw cold as just pure sensation, to kind of feel the headachy tiredness as just free sensation and space. And after a little while, there was an internal shift. There was actually a little more of a joyous presence. I wouldn't call it a wild, ecstatic joy, but it was a sense of well-being. And this is really the key to the practice. I think it was who was it that said? Werner Erhard, who said, the quickest way to be happy is to choose what you already have. So there's something enormously powerful about actually just saying yes to our experience, whatever it is, and to notice where we're labeling good or bad. As the third Zen patriarch said, this path is not difficult for those who have no preferences. But make the slightest distinction between good and bad, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So perhaps we can do a little reflection for a few minutes on this. If you like, you can close your eyes. And you might like to invite your attention inward. And just for these next few minutes, to allow yourself to relax again into the senses. And just to sense what it's like to hold your experience in the absence of any label of good or bad. To sense who you are in the absence of comparison or judgment, without trying to figure anything out. if you were to say yes to your experience, to choose what's happening. You might explore the quality of presence that may emerge with that. And if you like, you can deepen the breath just a little bit. And as you're ready, you can open the eyes or you can remain with the eyes closed. So this is our challenge or our invitation to hold our experience without setting up what we like against what we don't like. One of the most helpful instructions for me in the practice of meditation is to observe the attitude in my mind and to notice how they're what are referred to as the three poisons, the three qualities of mind that sabotage our capacity for joy, described as greed, hatred, and delusion or confusion. Hatred being the sense of aversion or judgment or pushing away. Greed, the wanting or clinging. And delusion or confusion, the sense of just disconnection to what's actually happening. At any given time, we can observe the attitude in the mind. I noticed for myself during that little meditation, kind of a flash of irritation at the conversation outside the door. But then as soon as I noticed my irritation, I realized that there are really happy voices out there. That there was a sense of connection and kind of a life-filled conversation going out there. And the aversion just sort of melted when I was able to recognize that. So at any given time, we can pause and notice how we're relating to our experience. That can, again, open up new possibilities. Of course, we live in concepts. We live in stories. I think one of the reasons why it's so cool to hang out with dogs and small children is there's an immediacy in the moment, kind of that joy of just saying yes to whatever's there. We recognize that quality inside ourselves. So the question becomes, how do we cultivate joy? How do we cultivate joy in a time of unbelievable stress and tension in our culture? We're such a fear-rich culture right now. Do you ever notice how little kids oftentimes they'll plant a sunflower seed in a little Dixie cup? A friend of mine, her daughter did that in school, you know, planted her little sunflower seed. And about every 3 hours, she wanted to dig it up and take a look at it and see how it was doing. And there's something about kind of the verified faith that we cultivate over time, of trusting that if you just water the seed, it's going to grow by itself. And it's very, very hard sometimes to trust that our meditation practice or whatever practice we're doing that cultivates a sense of presence, to really trust that it's working. We kind of want to dig it up and evaluate it. We so quickly move into judging ourselves for how well we're doing in our practice. And it's so important to remember that when we practice meditation, there is a quality of oftentimes of calming and feeling good. But at the same time, because it is a transformational practice, it's designed to bring up what needs your attention. what needs healing. So eventually we get a sense of verified faith. We realize that as we continue to practice, that there's more ease, there's more of a sense of well-being. I know I've shared before the story that Pema Chodron talks about, how she'll hear people talk about their great insights in meditation. And she says that meditating for 35 or 40 years or whatever it's been, she's never had a breakthrough. And she's never had like a fantastical insight. And she really gets jealous of the people who do. But when she pauses and looks back on her life, she realizes that there has been a gradual awakening. And I find that in the same way. When I contrast my life from a year ago or 2 years ago, I see that there's a little more equanimity. There's a little bit less anxiety than there was a few years ago. So we grow really, really fast as humans till we're about 20. And then we kind of stop growing physically. And some of us stop growing mentally and emotionally as well. We get frozen in our beliefs, and we get frozen into our sense of what we can expect out of this life. And some people continue to grow. And to me, this is the power of spiritual practice. It wasn't that many years ago when science was telling us that you only had so many brain cells. And you basically used them up and then you were done. And now through using functional MRIs, looking at the brain, we're discovering this immense capacity of the brain for neuroplasticity, that the brain can continue to grow and evolve and change. And over 10,000 studies on the brain as it relates to meditation in the works right now that are really demonstrating that there is this incredible evolution that happens when we practice meditation. Robert Thurman actually described meditation as an evolutionary sport. That when we can consciously bring our attention into the here and now and consciously contact the nature of this mind to judge and compare and to seek understanding, when we can identify the different mind states of aversion, of greed, of worry, of anxiety, of doubt, of criticism, when we can name them and identify them and be with them, the brain begins to shift in powerful ways. We have more access to the brain than we had before. And I would hope that in your practice of meditation or whatever it is you do that brings you present, that you feel a sense of greater aliveness, a greater sense of arriving, maybe even a sense of evolving. By the way, when I was writing the word evolving, my spell check put in the word evil doing. I thought, wow, I wonder if some fundamentalist is doing the spell check thing here. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the science of meditation practice and how it relates to joy. This stuff is really, it's really interesting to me. So there are these factors of awakening that were described by the Buddha. There's seven different faculties that go into kind of waking up this evolving brain. Just to review them briefly, then I'd like to tie them into how they work in how we can pay attention and how that can lead to what's called access concentration, which leads to these states of joy and rapture. So the first quality is mindfulness. We need to be aware. The second quality is a quality of investigation. We have to be curious as to what's going on. The third characteristic is energy. You've got to have energy to do this kind of work. The fourth is joy. There has to be a quality of joy or rapture in order to cultivate this awakened, evolving brain. The next quality is tranquility, a quality of calm. The next is concentration, the capacity to stay present. And the final quality is a quality of equanimity, which means the capacity to be with anything as it comes up. So there are a lot of different faculties in here, and in many ways they seem almost paradoxical. How is it that you can have energy and feel a sense of tranquility at the same time? How do we cultivate a way of being concentrated, but at the same time mindful, non-judging? So it's a very delicate state of how we can cultivate this internal place of evolution. But we can do this. We can actually train the mind to do this. So really what happens kind of maybe in an ideal moment, because so much of the time the mind is either on fire, it's chasing after something or running away for something else. But when we can call our attention in one place and we can begin to cultivate these faculties, we start to pay attention to what's happening. And then something in our inner experience gets our attention. So we start to get really interested in it, whatever that phenomenon may be. And in that level of interest, there's the quality of discovery. It's kind of that love of, wow, what is this? And with that sort of love of discovery, energy begins to arise, because there's some level of enthusiasm going on here. That energy leads to a quality of joy. And that joy and engagement into the object leads to a sense of tranquility. And the tranquility takes us deeper into concentration, which gives us access to equanimity. The doorway is paying attention or mindfulness of non-judging awareness. There are many, many different techniques that are taught in meditation. And as I've mentioned before, you can get trained in meditation in one school, and I guarantee you there will be another school that will give you exactly the opposite instructions. One school will tell you to close your eyes. Another will tell you to never close your eyes when you meditate. One tradition will have you focus on concentration practice. Another will say, no, you need to be focused on awareness, and that will cultivate concentration. So many, many different techniques. The Buddha, of course, engaged in all different techniques and all different traditions as part of his intentionality around waking up. For many, many years, and reportedly about 7 years, he engaged into very deep austerities, really kind of denying the body, using intense concentration. He realized at one point, and whether the story is true or just sort of mythological, you know, the story goes that he would eat one grain of rice less every day as a way of like fasting and purifying, until the point that he actually lost consciousness. And when he came to, his realization was that the path of denial, the path of exclusion, was not leading to liberation. And so he developed what he called the middle way. He said, if you think that you're going to fully wake up by denying the body and denying the senses, you may find that doesn't work. At the same time, you may find by indulging the senses and indulging the mind, that may not work either. But something in between here is kind of that golden place to cultivate. So after all these austerities, he had tried all these different techniques. And when he was meditating under a tree, he had a memory when he was about 6 years old. Every spring in the culture in which he was raised, there was a ceremony where they would plow the fields in the spring. And everyone would come together, the nobility as well as the peasants, and apparently the nobility would take part in the plowing. And he was sitting under a under a tree that was in full bloom and flowering. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And there was such a sense of harmony and joy and peace in the community that he remembered that moment as being a moment of joy, a real moment of bliss. And he took that experience into a sense of deep concentration, a sense of joy and concentration. And supposedly, when he investigated that experience, he was cautious because he didn't really trust the pleasantness of it. But he realized that the joy that he had in that experience as a young man was a non-sensual joy. That it was an internal joy that had really nothing to do with sensuality. And so he took that into his practice, and that was an integral part of his waking up. So he then taught about how to use joy as a means of bringing yourself deeply into the present moment. So actually, joy and delight and rapture and bliss are a big part of the Buddhist approach. There are some schools that are all about concentration. In the Zen tradition, they'll say you should meditate like your hair's on fire. You know? Sometimes they give the instruction, you know, die on the cushion. You know, just get so concentrated. Great benefits come out of that practice. I've had amazing experiences doing concentration retreats. But another approach is to explore what it's like to cultivate concentration with a quality of joy. So I hope that you're not thinking, you know, I'm not a very joyous person. I must be a real loser. I'm never going to be able to figure this one out. But I'd like to lead a little experience on how you might explore using this quality of joy and concentration together. So if you like, you can close your eyes again. And Thich Nhat Hanh often articulates the smile meditation, which can be a wonderful way to sort of escort our awareness toward a quality of joy or happiness. And you might imagine or feel a little smile at the corner of the eyes. And you might imagine or feel a slight smile at the lips. As his niece gives this instruction, which struck me as a little silly until I tried it. He said, to imagine the smile of a tiny baby on your lips. And you might imagine or feel a smile in your heart. Now, for just a few minutes, we're going to explore a technique for concentration meditation, where we're going to narrow our attention to the breath, to right at the rim of the nostrils and across the upper lip. So you're actually sensing the breath outside your body. And you might find it helpful here to let the body be perfectly still. And as I name these seven factors of awakening, you might just feel or imagine either where they are in your experience, or even just your willingness to feel or to know them. The quality of mindfulness, of non-judging awareness. The quality of curiosity or investigation. And in that investigation, in that love of discovery, the energy that emerges from that love of discovery or learning. And sensing, however it may exist for you, in that arising energy, a quality of joy, a quality of upwelling. Noting a quality of tranquility, of calm. The quality of concentration. The quality of equanimity. In this practice of concentration, energetically there's a sense of not pushing too hard nor too little, of attending to the object, the sense of the breath outside the body. Of the act of investigation of what is here. As you're ready, letting the breath deepen. And when you're ready, allowing the eyes to open or remaining with the eyes closed. It has always felt to me an inherent paradox that concentration would lead to joy. But concentration, because it calms the mind, can allow for this possibility of an upwelling. In some forms of concentration practice, there are what are called access to the jhanas, or deeper and deeper states of concentration, which is an extraordinary investigation. I've had the good fortune in longer, usually only available in longer retreats, but in month-long retreats, when the mind gets more and more still, this sense of you can begin to feel these seven factors of awakening just become more accessible as the mind is less and less distracted. And there can be this sense of an upwelling, kind of an organic sense of just the aliveness of the moment without the mind drifting into the past or the future. And at first, it feels that sense of joy or rapture feels like this is it, like you've arrived. I remember reading about the jhanas and hearing that description and not really getting it until I had the experience of feeling like, well, I'm done, this is it. The level of concentration that emerges of joy is very powerful. But then the instruction is to look for what's more stable than that sense of joy. And you begin to realize that there's something more subtle than that. And it becomes more and more subtle. Each one of the stages becomes more and more subtle. In this very deeply concentrated state, one of the main insights I had with concentration and kind of the joy practice was feeling at one point my concentration was so strong that my mind just went to my right hand. And I just was feeling my right hand, and almost instantly it started to feel really warm. And it got really, really hot. And I thought, whoa, this is kind of cool. So I thought, well, I wonder if I can do that with my left hand. So I just moved my attention to the left hand, and then the energy started moving there, and that hand got really, really warm. And then I thought, well, I wonder if I can make one hand warm and the other one cool. So I did that, and after 3 or 4 minutes, like, wow. And it was like, I wonder if I can switch it. So I switched it. And then I realized, I had, remember the story of, you may know, have heard of Swami Rama. He was the founder of the Himalayan Institute. One of the first yogis to come over from the East, that they did the early biofeedback on him. And one of the things that he could do was he could change the temperature in one hand, much warmer in the other. You know, he could do that back and forth thing. And so I thought, I'm doing what Swami Rama did. Isn't that cool? And then I realized, right after that, this thought was like, well, this is fun, but it's not liberating. And it was such a powerful little insight. Concentration can really open us up to this sense of non-sensual joy. It can bring you very, very deeply into the present moment. But it's very important to remember that it's a tool. It's a very powerful way of training the mind. But it's not the end. It's a very common thing for many people as they move deeper into meditation to move into the jhana practice. And people practice it for years because it feels so good. It's probably the most sustained joy that I have felt is just that sense of being deeply, deeply present without the mind wandering into the past or future. But it's very important for us to remember that we're really looking at the balance, cultivating our capacity to be here, but also cultivating this quality of non-judging awareness. So I want to just end with a short quote from André Gide, who said, "Know that joy is rarer and more difficult and more beautiful than sadness. Once you make this all-important discovery, you must embrace joy as a moral obligation." Such a powerful statement. And as I know I've shared here before, particularly in this world of suffering, being surrounded by so much stress in this culture, that when we come from a place of anger or a place of resentment, we can get some things done. When we come from a place of joy, and when we come from a place of love and compassion, our impact is dramatically enhanced. So to take time and really investigate, what's between you and feeling joy? What are the ways that you can actively, consciously cultivate your capacity for joy? It not only changes your life, but it absolutely changes the life of those around you. So I'm going to pause here. Just wondering if any comments or questions or anything at all on this topic or or anything whatsoever. Yeah. I will repeat, yeah. So you spend a lot of time with people who are suffering profoundly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, how not to be overwhelmed by suffering, particularly when you're professionally working with people who are suffering. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, when old friends will say, you know, ask me how I'm doing, you know, one of my jokes is, well, I'm in the suffering business, you know, it's booming. So, I know I've spoken about this before, but the phrase, my cup runneth over, I find to be such a helpful little metaphor. And when your cup is flowing over is when you're rested, when you're filled with so much well-being that you can't hold it back. You know, that's when we're just spontaneously kind, you know. My particular opinion is when people say meditation and yoga, all that stuff, it's so self-indulgent. I really feel that getting our cup to overflowing is our responsibility. Because the truth is, the suffering will not end. And the real work, the really deep work, is to find a way where you can be in a place where your cup is overflowing in the face of all of that. It's not easy, but it's a very, very profound inquiry. Because when you are overflowing, everyone wins. Everyone gets the benefit. So then it becomes a real question of, so what can you do in your life that increases your capacity for joy and well-being? And it's not just meditation. It's all the skillful means of how you manage your energy to really look at in your life what cultivates some more wholesome states in your life. You know, what cultivates less wholesome states? What are the drains? You know, what are the gains? Yeah, boy, I know that one really well. One of the interesting articulations in Buddhist psychology is how every state has what's called a near enemy. You know, so happiness is a beautiful beautiful whole state. But then there's another state that kind of looks like it, but it's not that, which is just as you described, it's complacency, it's resignation. You know, resignation has some of those qualities, but it's not that state of happiness. And just as compassion, the near enemy of compassion is pity. You know, we may feel our heart touched, but when we pity someone, we've created a sense of separation from them, as opposed to that pure, like, quivering of heart connection. And I had a very profound time in my life when I realized that I was trying to live a life of surrender. But what I realized was I was living a life of resignation. And it wasn't the same thing. So to kind of be aware of that, I mean, just to be able to see and name that sense of complacency, if you can name it, you've already begun to sever your identification with it. and might allow you to investigate that a little bit more. Does that help at all? It's such a fine line, isn't it? You know, I feel like for everything, for every front, there's a back. You know, there's a quality of wanting which is exquisite, which is a very there is pure wanting. You know, the wanting to be fully expressed. You know, the wanting to have every part of you engaged into life. You know, the wanting to have an awakened mind and awakened heart. You know, the wanting to be a contribution. Those are wonderful qualities of wanting, which we can actually cultivate. Then, of course, there's sort of the shadow side of wanting, which is the, you know, wanting the things which we think we want, but aren't necessarily what really lead us to real happiness. And that's one of the things the Buddha talked about when in his awakening. He looked around. He said, everyone is going after exactly the opposite of what will lead them to happiness. So just seeing that is so powerful. Doesn't mean it's easy. Yes.
So my meditation practice, I breathing, you know, for an hour a day, or is it just a matter of time?
Oh, what a great question. There are many different techniques. And I think it's really critical to explore different techniques to see what really is a match for you. You may find that with anxiety, for example, which is something I work with a lot, a concentration practice can be very helpful because it can be very effective at calming, you know, calming the mind. What I've noticed for myself is the more I practice, the more ah, that's so good. That's great. Yeah. So there's an interesting phrase in the sort of transformational practices that talks about how we're moving from the known to the unknown, how we're moving from the darkness to the light. So when you're feeling more joy than what you're used to, you're moving into the unfamiliar because there's a level of familiarity with the chaos or the, you know, the stress that you're really used to. So it can actually be very interesting to really pay attention to that, to really investigate that. So when you're going to work, for example, and you're feeling happier, you're a little bit out of your habitual vibration. Yeah, you're looking up instead of down. An interesting thing to ask yourself is, what story am I believing right now? And then to ask yourself, is that true? Is what I'm believing true? Because I really do see that when we begin to practice, we become more sensitive. We begin to make choices that are informed from something that is less anxious than our habitual way of being. And we can almost start to feel like we're starting to spiral up a little bit. You know, the landscape looks the same, but the elevation is beginning to feel a little bit different inside. And oftentimes, because it's so unfamiliar, there is some kind of self-sabotage. Because we'll gravitate back toward what we're familiar with. So as you begin to feel a shift like that, begin to feel more happiness, more joy, it's very helpful to really pay attention as to what you're believing about that and also how you can continue to deepen your practice. One of my teachers talked about how when you practice meditation or, again, or anything that's transformative, you begin to build energy, you know, physical energy, emotional energy, and psychic energy. And it's like you're putting money in your checking account. And I don't know about you, but what I tend to do is when I start to feel good, that's when my practice starts to drop off a little bit. Because I'm at a level that I'm really enjoying, so I start writing checks against my checking account. And it's a really interesting phenomena to see that when you start to feel a sense of buoyancy, to continue to reinvest, which is not just meditation, but to look at all the ways that you can continue to build vritti, build energy in your life, the kinds of friendships, the kind of activities that will be more and more wholesome, because it sounds like you're kind of on a roll, which is a good thing. We got to talk. I'm aware of our time. Our time has flown. Thank you so much for your kind attention. If you'd like to sign up for our mailing list over there, please feel free. Thank you, as always, for your generosity. May you have an outrageously joyful evening and beyond.